You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Profoundly Pointless. My name is Nick Van Zandt. Coming up in this episode, disc golf and the funnest things to throw.
I think that that's so entertaining, and that's what drew me to the sport when I first started, and how much more involved it is than just throwing a disc. You got to shape the disc, go around trees, and there's so many more variables than I started off sleeping in my car, traveling around all the tournaments that the professional tour had. And I wasn't making any money sleeping in my car. And so it just turned into a battle with myself to fight off what people are telling me. And as a young kid, that's hard. That's a funny one. That's the difference between 4 or 5 years ago and now, is there's a little bit more benefit, I think, now that more people know about it.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, like, download, subscribe, share, leave a review. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. So our first guest is now the best disc golfer in the world. But just a few years ago, he was sleeping in his car, eating off the dollar menu. So it's really a fascinating story about not only the ins and outs of what it's like to be a professional disc golfer, but also what can happen if you stay committed is something that you're passionate about. This is professional disc golfer Ricky Wysocki. Real quick, I did something to my audio, but Ricky's is great. His story is fascinating, and I don't usually talk much in interviews anyway, so I hope you enjoy.
So from an outsider's perspective, it seems like disc golf is suddenly way more popular.
Yes, our sport has grown leaps and bounds throughout the past 2 years. I think the pandemic was actually, we have a professional organization, the PDGA, and they actually grew like 10 years worth of growth in 2 years. So like I said, the pandemic, people want to be outside, people want to be in the local parks, and why not throw discs around and play a local course and gain a new hobby in the process.
Do you think that will last, or do you think this is like a blip and we ride this thing as far as we can?
So for me personally, I think that the sport, and as fun as it is and how exciting it is to throw shots and see how a disc flies, I think that that's so entertaining, and that's what drew me to the sport when I first started, that I think that once people try the sport out and really see how fun it is and how much more involved it is than just throwing a disc. You got to shape the disc, go around trees, and there's so many more variables than what meets the eye when you first play it, that people will continue playing even after hopefully the pandemic is over. And so I think that the growth is sustainable, and the people that are playing are going to continue to play, and then there's just going to be more and more people that find the passion, just like the people that already are playing disc golf.
Okay, so like outsider again. To me, it looks like you're throwing a frisbee, right? Explain to me why that it's so much more complicated than that.
Just like any professional sport, there's so many different levels to it. There's someone just starting, like a lot of the people over the pandemic, and then there's people like me that practice, train, work out, and it's my career. That's what I do. I travel, and I'm a professional disc golfer. And so I think that that's the beauty of it, is there's somewhere for everybody to fit into the sport.
When did you realize, like, you were, oh, I'm good?
So I grew up in Ohio, and I just grew up near a local course. They had a local park near me. I could almost throw a disc to the course from where I grew up. So that was definitely a bonus. And so I just grew up. I went to the course, played, and practiced every day, and I just fell in love with disc golf. I just enjoyed watching a disc fly. I enjoyed when all the body movements work together and you threw a good shot. It's much like golf, that the form and is so important, and how you move your body propels the disc. And so I like the individuality of it. It's you control your destiny. If the shot goes good or goes bad, it's all up to you. And so, yeah, that was what really drew me to it. And yeah.
Why are you good at it?
A lot of different reasons, but I think that I've always been athletic. I've always loved competition. I've been the type of person that finds something and I go all in on something. Whether it's, for me, it's been like nutrition, health and wellness, disc golf. And so I did whatever it took to grow as a person, as an athlete. And do whatever it takes to just keep getting better and going up the pyramid of growing through the ranks of the sport and growing up as an amateur, a junior, an amateur, then a professional. And so for me, it was just, I dove out in the deep end. I went on tour, on the professional tour, when I was like 16, 17 years old. And of course, I didn't succeed at first. I started off sleeping in my car, traveling around all the tournaments that the professional tour had. And I wasn't making any money, sleeping in my car, eating off the dollar menu at McDonald's just to make it. But that allowed me to get exposure, allowed me to gain experiences that I would have never been able to experience if I didn't sleep in my car and eat off the dollar menu. And so that's kind of what shaped me in my career. And I think it's just a test of my personality of, I'm going to do whatever it takes and, you know, put all my eggs in one basket. Because you always hear people saying, oh, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket. But sometimes you have to really get paid off on your career path or what your vision is.
Did you ever think of like, this ain't going to work?
Obviously, you know, as a young kid, you know, you don't mind. You know, I think it's easier to grind it out and like I said, sleep in your car and do all the things I was doing as a rookie to try and make it. And so there was times that, yeah, that there's adversity. You're like, I'm not making any money. I'm out here just basically donating my entry fees to the professional field. And you know, it costs money to live, costs money to enter the tournaments. And so you just kind of reflect and just think, hey, maybe this isn't for me. But I fought through that and I just kept practicing and I kept my mind to doing everything I needed to do to get better and grow, even if it was just a little bit. You know, from week to week, you grow that little bit. Even if you're not making money, you're growing as a player, and that's going to slowly pay dividends as my career developed. And that's luckily what happened for me.
From a physical standpoint, though, it's not like Ricky's got the best design wrists for snapping the frisbee, right? Like, there's not something like a basketball player, right? Like, you got to be pretty tall. There's not something physically about you that like, oh man, that guy's a, ooh, he's a disc pro right there.
So actually there kind of is a lot of top players are long and lanky. That's kind of like a very common trait for people that can throw far. So obviously that's one of the many ways to measure someone as a player is how far you can throw. And just like any sport, you're always wanting to push the limits. How far can you throw? How can I gain more distance? Just like golf, you know, the more distance you have, the easier it is to play courses because you're farther, a lot closer to the hole. So same to disc golf, same for disc golf. So a lot of the top players, obviously not all of them. There's just like basketball. There's some players are 5'7" and are good, and there's players that are 7'2" that are good. You know, but in general, longer, lanky, 6'4", 6'5", a lot of players, I'm 6'4", myself, a lot of the other top players are 6'4", 6'5", that long, you know, long arms, being able to get full, better extension when you're reaching back and trying to get the leverage on the disc. So to answer your questions, yeah, there is a certain builds that are better off and set you up to throw further. Don't get me wrong, there's shorter players on tour that harness a lot of energy and throw really far as well, but it's just like a lot of sports that, you know, they may have to work harder. They have to, you know, fight a little harder to gain that same distance that maybe someone of my height or even taller than me would.
So what separates a pro like you from somebody who's just really good? Like, are you throwing it farther? Are you more accurate? Can you like curve it around a building? Like, what what makes you a pro?
I think it's my training. I think that, you know, I take it serious. I'm, you know, I work out a lot. I do a lot of resistance bands, stretching, eating healthy, stability, mobility drills with my workouts. I'm doing a lot of that. And so, and then when it comes to physically on the course, it's a lot of, yeah, I can make the shots when I need to. I've been on tour for now 10, 11 years. So I've got a lot of experience, and so it all pays off. And it's just like any sport. You want to be able to make that putt or make that long shot down the stretch of a tournament to win that tournament. And so the people that can handle the pressure and handle adversity are going to separate themselves within the sport, being from a good to, you know, a top 1% in your sport, me being the best player in the world. Yeah, there's certain things and certain shots that I'm better at on a higher percentage. It's just like any sport, higher percentage. If I have, let's say, just for disc golf, we use feet, so like a 30-foot putt, and say the 20th place guy in the world, yeah, we both may make that putt, but I may make it at 95%, he may make it at 87%. And so that percentage is going to come into play eventually, and that's where that small, minute difference makes a big difference. Say that last putt may be for the win on the last hole of a tournament, and that's why I'm number one, and that's why maybe some other people are not. It's all about percentages and how you get the highest percentages in each category: putting, driving, approach game.
So I hope this question doesn't come off as like a jerk question, but did people ever kind of try to discourage you or other pros? Right, like I'm imagining the scene in the movie where the dad is like, Ricky, what's he doing with his life? He's a professional golfer, right? Like, did people ever kind of do that to you?
People definitely tried to say, hey, you can't make this a career. You can't do that. You can't, you know, and it just goes back to like, and my parents actually did it because my parents wanted, obviously they want to look out for the best for their kid. And I was playing a lot of baseball and I was very good at baseball. And I felt like I could have went to college potentially. And, But I decided to go on disc golf tour instead. And so there was people that my parents were the number one, obviously at 16, 17 years old. I wanted to call them and tell them about my life, but they weren't really interested because they wanted me to go the conventional path. And at the time, disc golf wasn't really what it is now. There wasn't really much of a career path there. And so for me, it was different than most other people because nowadays I think there's career paths for young kids and players coming up way more than it used to be. But yeah, for me, I had to fight through, you know, people telling me, no, you can't do that. And, you know, and then you start doubting like, hey, maybe this disc golf thing isn't for me, or it's not going to make me any money, or it's not going to give me what I want. But, you know, I got to travel the world. I got to see so many new places, new courses that it wasn't just all about the money either at the time.
This is something that kind of fascinates me, right? Because we've talked to people who have a kind of a similar story in the sense that, like, how do you stick with something when everybody else is like, you're wrong, but you know you're right? Like, how do you stick with that?
Yeah, that's a hard question because it's like, you know, it's, I didn't, you know, at the time you don't really, you know, you have to, it's basically, it comes to a point where it's all mental. It's all, hey, this person's telling me one thing, I know something else. So what's gonna win? Am I gonna let someone else win that's telling me, hey, you can't do this, or am I gonna be mentally strong and say, hey, no, I'm going to do this? So for me, it was the mental fortitude to fight through that and say, hey, like, the sport can grow. I'm gonna grow as a player, as an athlete. I can get better. And at the time, it was like you had to be like, you know, top one or two in the world to really make any money. Now it's like the top 50 or 100 can really make money in the world. And so for me, it was like very far-fetched to say, hey, I'm going to be the number one player in the world at one point and make money, make a brand, and really have a following enough to where I can make a living out of it. And so it just turned into a battle with myself to fight off what people are telling me. And as a young kid, that's hard because you get easily influenced by other people. And you know they're just looking out for your best interest. So you're like, all right, if these older, more experienced people are telling me this, that could be true. So you had to just completely, even though you know it was kind of true, you had to just kind of avoid it and not really think about it and just focus on yourself and focus on what you can control and not what other people are saying.
Are you ready for some harder/listener-submitted questions?
Yeah.
Do you have a general strategy when approaching a course?
I normally play, if it's a tournament event, a pro tour event, I will show up about 3 or 4 days ahead of time, scope out the course, play 3 or 4 rounds, take mental notes on each hole, how my disc reacts in certain holes, how it skips off the ground, how the wind's affecting it on that hole. So there's so many dynamics within each hole and each course that I'm dialing in mentally, so that way when I play the tournament, I have a mental note saying, hey, this hole does this, this hole, you know, discs roll off of this hill and generally trickle to the right, or there's water on the left that discs like to skip into naturally. And so there's just all these different variables that I'm thinking of to make my shot perfect as best as I can.
Do you get mad if somebody says frisbee golf instead of disc golf?
No, I don't get mad. I think it's just, you know, newer players or newer people in the sport, they see a frisbee and they see we're playing golf, and it's pretty easy to say, hey, it's frisbee golf. But everybody in the sport, like professional and anybody that's been around it, just calls it disc golf. But I think it's just, all it is, you know, you can tell if someone's a newbie or newer player or more seasoned veteran or someone that's been around the game, that's how you can kind of decipher the two. But it's not really like, hey, we judge the people that call it disc golf or frisbee golf. It's not like that. It's just another way to call it, and we don't really take offense to it. Some people do, but me, I don't take offense to that.
Like, what's the difference between the frisbee and the disc, right? Because I've tried the sport before, and I can throw a frisbee, but I tried to throw that thing, and I'm like, what the fuck?
So a frisbee is like what you think of, like a beach frisbee. It's real, like real thick. It's real big in the hand. And then, so I would say like it's thick like that. I would say like that thick versus a disc golf disc is like real thin. Yeah. It's real thin and it has, it's really aerodynamic. So that's the difference between a frisbee and a disc, is the aerodynamics, how far it goes. So a regular disc golf disc can go way further if you throw it right than an actual like beach frisbee or an ultimate frisbee or whatever. Something with a real thicker lip and not quite as aerodynamic. So that could be, that's a big difference between frisbee golf and disc golf, potentially, if you really want to get, you know, nerdy with it.
Do you throw it differently?
No, you throw it similarly, but the motion's the same, but there's little intricacies like how you release your wrist on certain shots based on how the frisbee flies. So in disc golf, you basically, Your wrist and your arm is where the disc is going to go. So it's just, think of it like a club. If you finish with your club face open, your ball is going to go right. So I finish with my wrist down and my arm like this, my frisbee is going to go left, just based on the gravity and aerodynamics of how a disc flies. So essentially, your arm and your wrist control where the disc goes, and that's the most important thing in a throw.
When you look at like an amateur, what are you seeing that like, ooh, you're doing this?
So the biggest flaws when I see newer players is they like to throw it like right up and straight up in the air. And it's just like lifting your shoulders up one way or another instead of trying to keep a good posture and rotating. That's the most important thing. And almost what I like to tell people is, it's like, if you want to throw straight, which is the most important shot when you're first learning, is you got to feel like you're sliding your arm across a tabletop to keep that nice flat plane coming through. Yeah. So if you deviate from that, if you go too low or too high, you're not going to be on that tabletop. So if you can slide across that tabletop all the way through your shot, all the way through your throw, then you're going to have a nice flat shot. And so in general, that's a great tip for beginners to start and learn how to practice and throw straight.
Favorite course that just has your number.
So my favorite course is probably in Vermont. So Vermont, they have a ski resort, Smuggler's Notch Resort. It's in Vermont. It's a well-known ski resort. And then in the summer, they turn into like a world-class disc golf course. And we have big events. We've had the world championships out there. We have big events every year. So it's an amazing property. And it's one of the most well-known on the tour. And then course that has my number. Let's see here. There's a course in... And so in Europe, there's a European Open. It's in Finland. That course it always seems to challenge me a lot. It's a course that has just a lot of OB, a lot of out of bounds, and I just for some reason don't play very well there. And it's in Finland. It's in Tampere, Finland. So there's always a big disc golf major there, and it's the European Open, and that's one of the obvious biggest tournaments in Europe.
Is there like a mecca for disc golf, right? Like you think of snowboarding, you're thinking of like Park City or something.
Yeah, I would say Charlotte, North Carolina. So Charlotte's got per capita one, some of the most courses, and the most pros are there because of the best courses. But yeah, if you're in the, say, the downtown area of Charlotte, and you drive like, let's say, 30 or 40 minutes in a circle any direction, you can hit probably like a couple hundred courses.
What's in your bag right now?
So Dynamic Discs, that's my sponsor right here. They're a disc golf manufacturer, and so I throw a lot of their discs and Latitude, and so they Latitude Discs and also Westside Discs. So those are the three companies I throw right now.
First thing, man, correct me on the numbers, right? 4 million, 4 years? Ooh. First thing you bought.
Actually, first thing I bought was crypto.
that is a modern purchase, isn't it?
So yeah, I've just always been a believer, and I wanted to invest in something, and I felt comfortable with that, and I'm a firm believer in it. So yeah, I wanted to invest in that, to make a good investment. I think that will pay off in the next 5 to 10 years.
Now, is it okay? So you're a professional. You can obviously do this full time right now, right? Can you though retire? Like when I'm done, I'm done. Like you're set financially for the rest of your life. Or do you make a pretty good amount and then you got to go get a job at Goldman Sachs or whatever?
So yeah, the for me and where I'm at in my career, the disc golf career, I would say, is much like an NBA or a baseball player. It's like 37 to 40. It was usually depending on how you take care of your body and injuries, all that. But yeah, and then after you retire, for me, it would be getting into like course design. So using my brand, my name, and everything. And going to city parks and saying, hey, I'm a world champion. I can design a disc golf course for your city. And so I have a brand and I have a following that would be totally worthwhile, and people would want that, and it would be a big draw. And so that stuff you can get into even after your playing days is working with a manufacturer to be a team manager for all the top professional players of that team, doing course design. So there's lots of different opportunities that once you build your brand, you can kind of parlay your playing career into your business career after that.
I'm going to ask this question exactly as it has been written so that it doesn't sound like I'm asking it. Does being a disc golfer help you or hurt you when looking for love at the bar?
That's a funny one. So I guess I guess I don't go to the bar for that. But if I did, I think it would be a lot more beneficial lately now that the sport's grown a lot, because more people have heard about it. If you went to the bar 4 or 5 years ago and said, hey, I'm a professional disc golfer, they'd be like, what's that? And then you got to like explain to them what disc golf is, and it kind of ruins the moment. You know, like you have to explain what you are a professional of. It's like, okay, well, that's not, you kind of killed the vibe there. But if you're like, oh, I'm a professional disc golfer, and they've heard about it, they're like, oh, that's cool, you know, it kind of impresses them. So yeah, that's the difference between 4 or 5 years ago and now, is there's a little bit more benefit, I think, now that more people know about it.
Residual benefits, man, you can't go wrong with that. That's pretty much all the questions we got. Is like, what's kind of coming up next for you? I know the tour's getting started soon.
Yeah, so I'll kind of share a little bit of my schedule. So yeah, I'm heading to Las Vegas. So the Las Vegas Challenge is the first tournament of the year. So we have a professional tour of like 20 to 25 events. They go anywhere from Vegas to Texas to Vermont to Portland, Oregon, to all the way to Europe. We have events in Norway. We have events in Finland. So there's a huge presence in Finland. And disc golf in Finland is they did a study on it, or stat, and it's the second most popular sport in Finland behind hockey. So it's hockey and then disc golf. So that's how much it's grown in other countries, and I definitely, who knows in the States, but maybe 5 years down the road, disc golf, I definitely see college sports, you know, getting into sponsorships or scholarships, I should say. So I don't think that's too far away. But yeah, so I'm going to be going on the tour, and every week is a grind, you know, traveling every week, going to a new city, playing new courses. It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of work, it's a lot of stress, and a lot of driving as well. So we're doing a lot of that, doing a lot of signings, disc signings at local shops and different things like that. But yeah, and if you're following, wants to get a get a hold of my schedule, you can check me out on Instagram on SockyBomb13 or Twitter. That's SockyBomb13 as well. So that's kind of where I keep up to date on my tour, what I'm doing, and you can get yourself involved in the disc golf world.
I want to thank Ricky so much for joining us. If you want to connect with him, we have linked to him on our social media accounts. We're Profoundly Pointless on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram, and we've also included his information in the episode description. Okay, now let's bring in John Shaw and get to the pointless part of the show. Have you ever unpacked at a hotel? Like, took your stuff out of your bag and put it in the dresser stuff that they give you?
My first immediate reaction is to say no to this. But then when I think a little bit on it, the answer is yes. Because when I first moved to Orlando, I stayed in an extended stay, which are great places, by the way. And I stayed there for maybe 3 to 4 months.
You stayed in an extended stay for 3 to 4 months.
It was not a good. There was a lot of alcohol because there was like an Applebee's right near me. There was a bar across the street.
Wait, which one, if you were going to have a night out, like, did you go to the Applebee's first or did you go to the bar first?
That's kind of a great question. It depended on the mood I was in. Like, if I was going to watch sports or something, I usually went to the bar. If I was going to eat first, I would usually go to Applebee's. And then go to the bar. Either way, I usually ended at the bar, one way or the other.
Have you ever had, like, gone to a place frequently enough that they knew your name?
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Yeah, you are much more friendly and likable than I am. I don't think I've ever gone to a place where somebody knew my name when I walked in. But how many days would you have to stay at a hotel before you would unpack and put your stuff in the dresser?
Yeah, so if it wasn't like an extended stay situation, probably 5 days, I'd say. Probably on the fifth day, I'd start to get antsy and probably put my stuff away.
I would say 5 days is correct. It would have to be 5 full days. Like, I would have to be there 5 days, but 6 nights. Do you think that the world will come to an end in your lifetime? Like, do you ever think that you will be involved in some kind of dystopian future? Like, that will happen in your lifetime? Do you feel like that?
I mean, no, I don't think so. However, I want to say yes. Just obviously, without going into detail, we know the current state of affairs. I'm going to say no. I don't think I'll see the quote unquote end of the world or, like a Walking Dead type situation or anything like that in my lifetime. I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen, but honestly, I could go 50-50. Like, if I would not be surprised if we end up in some kind of dystopian future in my lifetime. Like, I don't think that it would, but I wouldn't be shocked if we were. But you know what? I don't think it will be anything that we really see coming. Like, it's just going to be something that happens all of a sudden.
So you don't think it's going to be like a slow burn? You think it's going to be more of just one event, and then the next day we're in a dystopian world?
I don't know about next day, but I think it will be something that happens much faster than we anticipated. Like, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in like the period of a year or something like that.
I think there's going to be some rough times that may seem that way, but no, I don't think we'll ever get to that point to where the entire world.
I'm 50-50.
And you're usually like the realist, like pessimistic kind of guy. So for you to say 50-50 makes me wonder if I should just say yes at this point.
Yeah, I'm usually pretty optimistic about stuff like this. We're like, no, it'll all get worked out. But that's why I think that it won't be something that we really see coming. It's just going to be like, boom, your life just completely changes one day. Which is why I bought 4 days worth of cream corn the other day just to be stocked up and ready. Because that's going to help.
Cream corn? Like the canned cream corn?
No, dude, I just got a bag of cream corn and I'm just going to be carrying around with me. Yeah, I can't. What other?
All right, let's give some shout-outs.
Some shout-outs. We are now on week 7. We are now on week 7 of John talking directly into the microphone that we got for him. He still finds it to be entertaining, but we're 7 weeks
in. I honestly apologize to everyone out there, but I feel like...
you all like it.
So anyways, all right.
No, nobody likes it because it becomes, it's really loud.
It's not that loud.
Like, you know how a microphone works, right? Like, if you suddenly yell into it, that sound is transitioned to other people.
Well,
and so they're suddenly like, ah.
What if I talk like this the rest of the episode?
Why can't you, like, it's a microphone, dude. We're in 2022. It's not that great of an invention, right? Like, you should not be as impressed by a microphone as you are. And now that we're on this, let's talk about the subject of your clapping. All right? Will you clap one time for us? Because I want people to know that John has a distinctly unmanly clap.
It's true. All right, here we go. Ready? 3, 2, 1.
Now listen to my clap for perspective. How does that make you feel knowing that you have an unmanly clap?
I didn't even know it until we, you know, we do this before most of the episodes. And I had no idea. But the reason is you use a lot more palm than I do. I try to hit my palm, I don't. And it just sounds all awkward like this.
You clap with the top of your fingers when you got a palm clap a little bit more.
It's a solid question. I want everyone out there that's listening to clap. And I'm curious to know if you're a palm clapper or a whatever else clapper. God, that was bad. That was...
Your clap is so...
feminine.
Unmanly.
Hey, here's a follow-up question. When's the last time you clapped for something or somebody?
I'm not a public clapper.
Yeah, I didn't clap. I don't clap, really, as you can tell, for many reasons.
Do you want to do your candle of the month first, or do you want to do your shout-outs?
Oh, man, the first episode I forgot that it is going to be the first episode in March. I'm sorry. I'm going to have to take... I want to put a lot of effort into the candle. So let's do it next episode. I apologize, but it'll give people a reason to come back.
Okay, slow burn on the candle of the month.
Nailed it.
All right. All right, let's see here. Carl Harris, Carlton Bacon. I'm sure that's not a real name, but it's pretty awesome. Andre Medina, Kaplan Terahi, Carlos Martin, Daniel Tull, kind of rhymes with Shoal, Matt Cinquini, Matt Strobel, Soul Daddy Sammy. His handle is Hot Dog Meme, so I put him on there strictly because he had hot dog in his handle. And then Tyler I, you all get the shout-outs of the week.
Congratulations.
All right, let's see here. Would you rather be 16 years old for your entire life or 67 for your entire life?
Both of those are, like, equally bad.
Exactly.
I think I would probably have to go with 16. You could participate in everything that life has to offer as a 16-year-old, but you can't necessarily do it as a 67-year-old.
When I wrote the question down, I picked those 2 years because I thought they'd be difficult years. I'm glad you said they were. I feel like 67, you're right on the cusp of, like, not being too old, but, like, you're still pretty old. Given
there.
The physical aspects of those two ages, I'm just going to say 16.
Based solely along the physical aspects of it, not necessarily your station in life. Because I would rather have the station in life of somebody who's 67 years old, but not the physicality of somebody who's 67 years old. Now, if you went like 16 or 45, oh, that's easy. An easy choice.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? You've got to be getting up into the 60s before it even becomes like, oh, I don't know about that. Because even if you said, would you rather be 55 or 16? 55.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'd probably agree with you.
But imagine being 16 your whole life and always talking to 16-year-olds.
That would be...
Oh, that would be awful.
Yeah, but even if you're 67, you're going to be talking to 67 and older folks forever, which is probably just as bad.
You could talk down in age better than you could talk up in age. Like, a 16-year-old has nothing to say to anybody over the age of 20. Like, what are you even going to talk to them about?
Right. Oh, man.
Right?
I don't think...
Like, a 67-year-old, you could at least relive your life by talking to a 20-year-old. But if you're 16, what do you even have? Who can you even talk to?
I mean, I think for most of us, we don't realize how young 16 is till you get to be older, like us old fucks. I mean, 16...
You really 16's don't.
Pretty young. This is just a weird one, just because, I don't know, I had this conversation with someone not too long ago. You have to sleep on one of these for the rest of your days. A bunk bed, a shitty mattress that is under $200. So if anyone's bought a mattress, you know that's a real bad mattress. Or a water bed.
Oh, bunk bed. Because at the very least, you could be like, that's at least cool. Like, you could have a comfortable bunk bed, but a $200 mattress or a water bed, that's not a good look, right? Like, you're not inviting somebody of a love interest over and be like, hey, check out this water bed.
I mean, back in the day, it probably worked. I mean, Mama and Papa Scholl had a water bed till I was a teenager, I think. So,
I've never been on a water bed. Now, I had an air mattress until I was 30.
Okay.
But it was a nice air mattress. It was like a queen-size air mattress. And the reason is because there was something with the warranty that I essentially bought it when I was 18 and just kept going back every 3 years to get a new one. And they just kept, like, I don't know who had this policy at Bed Bath & Beyond, but they must have lost millions of dollars because you could just go back and say, hey, this thing's deflated. And I basically kept returning it for 12 years. Every two years, I took the thing back and got another one for free. And they were like, oh, just go grab one and walk out. Like, okay. No questions asked.
Wow. Okay. I wonder if that policy still is enacted.
I hope not, for the sake of their stockholders.
Oh, fuck.
Because I probably racked up, I'm not kidding you, maybe $2,000 to $3,000 worth of free air mattresses. I swear to you, I went through like 8 of them.
Yeah.
And paid for one and just kept returning them every 2 years. And they're like, okay, well, it's under the warranty.
I wanted to make like some sex jokes and things about those, but I'm just going to hold them.
I mean, if I had more skill, it probably didn't match up, but I don't need the best skis in the world. I'm not going down the toughest mountain, right? So what I was doing, it worked out perfectly well for that. What's a waterbed like? I've never slept on one.
I mean, it's what you imagine. I mean, it's really the secret I found to a waterbed. I had a waterbed till I was a teen. And then me and...
Oh, so waterbeds ran in the Scholl family. That was they believed.
And then actually this kind of goes with their top five. But my waterbed days were ruined when a friend and I decided to set up a dartboard against my bed. And, of course, these were metal-tipped darts, and we missed significantly, and multiple holes were put in the waterbed.
I don't understand why you would ever get a child a waterbed. Can you imagine being in the meeting at, like, Mattress Firm and, like, what should we do for a new venture? You know what?
Oh.
Let's fill these things with water. Send them out there.
Oh, wow. The modern waterbed was created by Charles Pryor Hall in 1968 while Hall was a design student at San Francisco State University.
How did that idea get off the ground, though?
Well...
Right? Like, how did he convince people that a waterbed was a good idea?
As of last year, waterbeds accounted for less than 2% of new bed sales, so they've gone downhill pretty quick. Let's just go on to our top five here today.
All right, so our top five is top five funnest things to throw.
My number five is water balloons.
Oh, okay. I thought about water balloons, but the pain in the ass of filling them up is really what ruins water balloons for me. It's just like they're fun, but the return on investment is not there for me with a water balloon. It's just too much work involved in making it and throwing it. And then you got to go buy it. And at no point in my life would I ever be like, you know what? Let's have a water balloon fight. I'm going to go to the store. Like if somebody already had them, I could see myself engaging in a water balloon fight. But I'm not going to go buy balloons to do that.
First off, the fact that you used return of investment and water balloon in the same sentence. You win today, sir. Congratulations.
It's ROI. My number five is a boomerang.
I assume you've thrown one?
I have thrown one. It's really fun to throw, but then you realize that this is a hard piece of wood and or plastic that you have thrown that is now coming back at you as fast as you've thrown it, And it's like, holy shit, get out of the way. This thing's fucking coming back.
I always wonder, like, I don't know the physics of a boomerang. So I don't know what, like,
no.
But I mean, how do they come back to you? Are you like the rotation of it? I mean, the wind?
There is a special way that you throw it. So my sister did something in Australia, brought me a boomerang, which is exactly what the gift you're supposed to get a teenage child is, a boomerang. And I just remember that there's some, you have to throw it at like a certain angle with your hand, and then it will come back around to you. But this is like imagine like taking a good hard stick, chucking it as hard as you can, and then seeing this stick come right back towards you.
Yeah, that's it.
And it doesn't come right back towards you. It comes like back in your general area.
That doesn't sound fun at all.
It's not fun. You're like, holy crap, how am I going to catch this thing?
Or just get out of the way.
So basically imagine someone throwing a baseball at you and you don't have a mitt. Like, do you really want to catch that? Not really.
So actually, I have children as my number four, kids.
Do you think that's okay to have children?
To throw them, it's fun. It's fun to throw them around, man. It's fun to toss them around, you know, throw them on a trampoline or throw them into a ball pit. It's fun. It's you know, or it doesn't have to be just kids. It can be adults. It can be anything. Throw people. I don't care.
I do like pushing people in the pool. I've always liked that.
And you were that guy.
Yeah, well, you can't really do it anymore because of phones. Like, now it's like, oh.
Yeah.
You can't really do it anymore.
See, we're older, so I don't think, like, I'm smart enough. I'm not going to, if I'm near the edge of the pool, I'm not having my phone anywhere near me just for the chance. Even if it's somebody I don't know, like, I'm just not taking that chance.
You're that worried about being pushed in a pool that you won't even keep your phone around you?
You know, you got to be careful around pools.
I understand that you got to be a little careful, but I think you're a little overly paranoid about being pushed.
Well, I also wear, you know, a complete set of clothes to the pool, too, just in case.
Well, that is true. My number four is fireworks. Specifically, I'm okay with black cats. Like, they're pretty fun to throw, but I'm specifically thinking of those, like, little poppers that you throw, and as soon as they hit the ground, they blow up. Like, those are pretty fun to throw.
Yeah, I don't mess with fireworks, so I'll let you stay with that.
Okay. All right. Way to bring it down. What's your number three?
I have food.
Oh. And,
I mean, if I had to pick like a specific time or event to throw food, I would probably say like drunk. Like, drunk throwing food's pretty awesome.
But I don't think that I've ever been in a food fight.
I don't know if I've actually ever been in a food fight, but I've been with you on many occasions where food has been thrown off of balconies and things like that. So for you to say you've never thrown food is a falsity.
I've never thrown food at somebody.
Except for those poor bastards who were just trying to get their cars.
Frisbee. Frisbees are pretty fun to throw. It's always fun to throw a frisbee.
The ROI on a frisbee throw, for me, is just not worth it.
There's more satisfaction about being able to throw a frisbee to somebody than there is any other kind of popular throwing object. Like, you throw a football to somebody, you're like, all right, that's not that big of a deal. Throw a baseball, not that big of a deal. But if you can throw a frisbee to somebody, there's a certain amount of like, oh, I got it to them. Mm. And that's where I would say that a frisbee has a very high return on investment in terms of like your ability to throw it. And if you can get it to them, like, you're excited, you just got it to them, which is why a frisbee is fun. Because every time you're like, oh, I got it there.
Yeah, I'm good. My number two. No, my number two, I just have sharp objects.
What I have. Knives is my number two. Yeah, I like throwing
knives. I've thrown axes before. That's kind of a crazy, weird feeling, throwing an axe over your head. Just sharp objects. So my number one, I think it has to be unanimous. It's just some kind of ball, whether it's a football, baseball. I mean, it's the best, you know, dodgeball, any kind of ball, football.
My number one is along those lines, but it's the funnest possible thing to throw, which is a snowball.
Snowballs. I agree. Snowballs are good. And I have snowballs actually, on my honorable mention, but I'm good. I'm good keeping it.
How can you not like throwing a snowball?
I like it. It's fine. It's not top five worthy for me.
What's not great about it?
Well, you need the right kind of snow. which you might get two or three times a year. You
do need the right.
And then the if you're not a good Packer.
But it's fun. It, right?
Like, a lot of times, like, I'm not good with gloves on, so I have to take my gloves off to pack it properly. So then my fingers start to get fucking cold. And then by the time you actually throw it, it's, you know, 3 minutes later, it's snow started to come off it. It's a love-hate relationship with me and snowballs. It really is.
Why do you have that difficult of a time making a snowball?
Because you gotta pack. You gotta pack it tightly. You gotta pack it right. It has to be the right size.
It takes me like 2 seconds to do.
Well, you know.
What are you doing that you can't make a snowball that quickly?
It's not that I can't make a snowball. It's just you gotta take off your gloves, and then you gotta pack it.
But why do you have to take your gloves off?
Because I can't. I want to pack it properly. I can't do that with the gloves that I have.
What kind of gloves do you have? I don't understand this. I really don't understand how you cannot make a snowball properly.
Well, I do make it properly. Why would that take? That's why it takes me a while.
But why do you have to take your gloves off to make it?
Because I'm not gonna explain it right. I like to be able to have full control over my fingers and making the snowball, and I can't do that when my fingers are in gloves.
But you really, it's almost better to make it with mittens on. That's really the best way to make it. Because you want to have that all together. Like, if you're spacing it out with individual fingers, then you're crushing through the snowball, right? Like, you need to have a certain, like, you need, like, a paddle kind of. The hand needs to be one consistent unit. If you spread it out, you're not making a good snowball.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not as awkward as I'm making it seem. It's not as bad. And it's not as, I don't know, difficult either as I'm making it seem.
Okay. All right. I mean, I just don't. Snowball to me is a solid number one. It's the funnest thing. Nobody's ever having a bad time in a snowball fight or when throwing a snowball. And you could throw a snowball at anybody because nobody's going to get really that mad at you. Unless you, like, hit them right in the face and they're not expecting it. And then
right in the face.
They might get a little upset.
I mean, to be honest, that's the only honorable mention I have, really, was just snowballs.
Oh, I've got a number of things. My wife suggested throwing shade at people. I don't think people use that terminology very much anymore, but like throwing some shade.
That's a good
I
one.
Like that. That's fun to throw. Bowling balls.
Okay. I mean, that could be in my number one, a different kind of ball.
Anything breakable.
Mm.
That's always fun to throw.
That's good.
Red turtle shells in Mario Kart. If you have the same name as somebody, are you going to point it out to them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have the same name as my father, the exact same name. So I'm quite used to it, actually.
Yeah, I've never been that kind of person.
Well, I mean,
if I have the same name or the same, now, if I have the same car as somebody, I'm going to say like, ooh, nice car, as I get into my same car. And I'm going to give them that stupid look that people give you when they have the same thing that you do.
I have a question.
Okay, that's going to go ahead and do it for this episode of Profoundly Pointless. I want to thank you so much for joining us. If you get a chance, leave us a review or a rating. We really appreciate it. It really helps us out. And let us know what you think are some of the funnest things to throw. I can't believe he doesn't. Like, what's wrong with throwing a snowball? What's the guy have? Like, clearly something has happened to him in a snowball fight. And there's also some residual emotional damage that he has from being pushed in a pool. He's a little bit too afraid of being pushed in a pool, if you ask me.